Welcome to the next RevDem episode. My name is Kasia Krzyżanowska and I am the RevDem editor. And today I am joined by Dermot Hodgson, who is a professor of political economy and digital technologies at University of Loughborough in London. And his most recent book is The Circle of Stars, a history of the EU and the people who made it, which was published by the Yale University Press and talks about the history of European integration since the Maastricht Treaty. Welcome, Dermot.
Thanks, Kasia.
So let me start our conversation with a quote, because just 2 years ago, Perry Anderson has started his famous set of essays on European integration, where he wrote that most of the literature on the European Union, and I quote here, and its prehistory is notoriously intractable, dull, technical, infested with jargon, matter for specialists, not general readers. But on the other hand, there is a bulk of really exciting literature that tries to deal with history of European integration from very different perspectives, like also critical, oftentimes critical. And my question to you would be, how does your book speak to this literature and how it is different from it? What new or under-discussed aspects does your approach highlight?
Okay, thanks for a really interesting question to start with. So my book, Circle of Stars, tells the story of the EU from the signature of the Maastricht Treaty in February 1992 to Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 and the aftermath of that incident. So it seeks to understand in a nutshell how the EU endured during the three decades of turmoil between these two momentous events. So this is a book aimed at a broad readership. And if you ask, I think, an average European on the street, who governs the EU? Well, a popular answer would be faceless technocrats. Now, we know as EU scholars that that's not the case, but I think that doesn't necessarily translate into popular discourse about the European Union. So I think what's different about this book is it tries to put people at the center of its story. And often as political scientists, we're trained to talk about institutions and states, and those kind of concepts are incredibly important. And they certainly feature in my academic work, but I really wanted to tackle this idea of the faceless technocrat head on and to tell a story about the EU based on people. Now, you obviously have to make a choice at this point. I chose three broad categories of actor to tell this story around with this book aimed at a broad readership. One was heads of state or government. The other were European officials. And the final one was right-wing populists. So the argument in a nutshell in the book is that the EU was driven during this period, above all, by heads of state or government. And those heads of state or government consistently looked to the EU in times of crises to try and weather those storms. Now, in a way, cooperation came relatively easy to these actors. And I think it came relatively easy in part because they had a very similar view of globalization. And that view of globalization, I argue in the book, was actually very simplistic and very naive, and it paid far too little attention to the downsides of globalization, particularly the cost to workers. And I think that naivety came at a heavy price because it left the EU vulnerable to right-wing populists who were able to stoke popular discontent with the European project, but also with globalization. So in a nutshell, what I think this book adds is a story of European integration with people at the center, and a story about how the EU endured, not because of technocrats, but because of heads of state or government, but at a heavy price, because we see right-wing populists getting stronger crisis to crisis.
Thank you very much for this overview. It's already tackles a lot of topics that we will unpack during our conversation. But you mentioned that you start from the Maastricht Treaty. So I really wonder, what is so significant about the Maastricht Treaty that you depart from this point of time? And then how this significance square with your observation that there is a declining popular support for European integration in the decades since?
Well, there are many good histories of the European Union that date back to the 1950s and indeed sometimes the interwar period. I chose to start in the Maastricht Treaty because I think something changed in 1992 when the Maastricht Treaty was signed. Now, what was the nature of that change? Well, I think it was at that very moment that policymakers came to understand that the so-called permissive consensus over European integration was over, that henceforth they would have to contend with citizens who had strong views about what the EU should or shouldn't be doing, and that that era of elite-driven integration was very much over. Now, the question is why that backlash occurred at that time. And I still think about this question. It's not really an easy one to answer simply, having written the book. But I think there was something about the substance and the process of the Maastricht Treaty that illustrated this change. On substance, clearly the European Union moved into highly sensitive areas. So it took the existing European community and built three very bold, well, potentially controversial projects on top of this: the euro, common foreign and security policy, and justice and home affairs. So they're sometimes called core state powers in the literature. So the EU enters a very sensitive domain right from the beginning. But I think there was also something different going on in terms of the process. François Mitterrand didn't have to call a referendum on the Maastricht Treaty. He chose to. And he chose to thinking he was going to win it comfortably and have his own declining political fortunes reversed. Actually, what we see is that that opens the door to a lot of contestation over European integration almost instantly. We see the same in Denmark. And so right from that very moment, we see a very different way of legitimating the European Union, which actually struggles to achieve its objective. It actually exposes the problems of legitimacy facing the European Union. Now, at this very moment, EU policymakers could have taken stock. They could have asked difficult questions about where this discontent was coming from. Instead, they pressed ahead with more treaty reform. So there was the so-called Maastricht leftovers, which is a small number of issues that had to be dealt with by 1996. They were pretty narrow. They could have been dealt with quietly. Instead, the demand for a more ambitious treaty reform takes off, and then you get Amsterdam. That doesn't address the problems of legitimacy facing the EU. And then we're thrown into a decade of treaty reform, which is designed in part to address the problems of legitimacy facing the European Union, but ends up amplifying that. So we see this in the backlash against the Nice, Lisbon treaties, and of course, in the failure of the European Constitution. So Jacques Delors is quite a nice quote from 1993 that I begin the book with, where he talks about the people having woken up, right? So something changed in Maastricht. On your question about public opinion, I think it's not in secular decline over this period, right? I note in the book that in 1991, 72% of respondents saw membership as a good thing. And by 1996, support is 48%. So that's a pretty steep fall off. But it doesn't decline consistently over the post-Maastricht period. It craters during the euro crisis for understandable reasons. But then there's a boost again around the time of the war in Ukraine. There's a sense of understanding about what the European project is for. So I don't think it's in secular decline. But what's clear is that public opinion matters in this period in a way that it didn't in earlier periods, rightly or wrongly. We enter a period in which, as some scholars talk about in the literature, EU policymakers are looking over their shoulders at the people.
Yeah, I think that those sensitive topics are indeed important in your book, and you capture it nicely by referring to popular protests or campaigns, also by including pictures of failed referenda, for example, in the Netherlands. So that was really nice to read about. But then let me focus more leaders, on the national leaders that you focus on in your book. You mentioned already that what was their reason for following the European integration, because they did not share an ideological commitment, but rather, as you mentioned, they believed that their countries could manage global crisis more effectively by working together. So my question would be, what such focus on national leaders and some EU politicians would say about the functioning of the EU? And then, as a lawyer, I have to ask this question: how does sidelining of the EU Court of Justice and the legal constitutional aspect help us understand the European integration?
So you've got to make a choice when you write a book like this. So, you know, I could have gone really narrow and told a story through one or two individuals. Instead, I wanted a kind of broad ensemble cast. So I wanted to bring in leaders and politicians from as many member states as possible over this three-decade period. But even after that, there's still people and actors that we leave out. There's not many economists in the book. And there is law, to be sure. So we look at treaty reform and constitutional law, the difficulties of not only codifying, but implementing and enforcing the EU's fundamental values. But you're right that there's not many judges or lawyers in the book. And my previous book was on treaty making, where I spent a lot of time thinking about law. And the lawyers that I worked with on this project, you know, asked exactly the same question as you. And I think it's quite a legitimate question. So I'm not trying to negate the importance of EU law, but I am trying to tell a story about politicians in this book. I note that you interviewed Tommaso Pavone a few podcasts ago in your series, and that was really, really a great episode. And I'm really impressed by his book, Ghostwriters, which shows it's possible, even in the quite closed world of law, in which judges very understandably don't want to go on the public record, don't necessarily give a lead. But in this book, Ghostwriters, Pavone does a fantastic job of showing you can do this kind of work in the quite secretive area of law. So he draws attention to the role not only of judges, but lawyers in the legal development of the European Union. So I don't deny the importance of this. I just had to make a choice in writing this book.
Yeah, of course, it's obviously legitimate. And then when you were doing those analyses, you obviously had to think about the features that national leaders have to possess in order to pursue domestic politics and also European politics. So in your opinion, what kind of features this national leader should have, and how one should act as a leader effectively, that governs a polity which has its sovereignty limited by the European integration as well? And my other question that is connected to those, how does being a right-wing leader actually influence cooperation with other heads of state or government on the European level?
Okay, so I think I'll probably resist the urge to play the role of Machiavelli here, right, in designing the kind of ideal type of leader. Because in this book, I got to look up close at, you know, dozens of national leaders over a three-decade period, and they all came across as pretty flawed individuals. I mean, even the most impressive of them might take a principled, value-driven stance in one policy area, but then shortly afterwards do the opposite in another policy area. So I was mindful of how actually flawed these individuals were as people. So I don't think there really is such an ideal type of leader. An interesting what-if question in the book is what would have happened if Jacques Delors had have run for and won the French presidency in 1995. He was very high in the polls in 1995. He was probably Europe's best known left-wing leader. And I think he had a reasonable chance of winning. And for personal reasons, he decided not to run. Had he won, I think he would have been a transformative leader in the way that Jacques Chirac never was as president of France. On the other hand, I think Delors probably would have suffered the same fate as many of the third way leaders in this book, which is that they have this extraordinary moment in power in the 1990s. They probably don't make the most of it. And then they diminish very, very quickly as a political force in the 2000s. So even someone like Jacques Delors, who understood the European project better than anyone and who could have been this transformational figure, I think probably would have suffered the same fate. Now, on your question about right-wing leaders, I guess it depends what sort of right-wing leader. So if we take a center-right leader, they had very little difficulty in, I think, engaging in EU cooperation, certainly in an area like economic policy. That's not surprising because the third way leaders on the left had borrowed the right's economic policies and the right kind of borrowed them back again. So if you look at the economic discourse in the European Union, the change from center left to center right majority in the European Council doesn't make much difference to economic policy. So there's a very smooth transition. And even David Cameron turns up as Prime Minister of the UK, and his initial focus on substance didn't last very long. It was almost third way in its argument that we need to focus on globalization, global poverty, and global efforts on climate change. So there was a uniformity there for better or for worse. If you talk about more radical right-wing leaders on the right-wing populist front, again, those leaders found it surprisingly easy to work with their EU peers. So there was obviously huge contestation over fundamental rights, and I would say a very ineffective attempt to enforce those rights against leaders like Viktor Orban, who in turn campaigned very aggressively against Brussels, against interference from the European Union. Day to day, Orban managed to cooperate on a lot of EU policies, right? And so there's a story that emerges in this book about the willingness of politicians, particularly in the EPP, to stand together despite, I think, legitimate criticism of where they stood on EU values. So it's a story in which center-right politicians take EU cooperation in their stride, right? There's nothing that new for them. Right wing on the populist front actually day to day managed to cooperate.
Before I delve into right-wing populism in detail, I wanted to follow up a bit on those national leaders and their features. Obviously, you did not provide this ideal type, but my personal question to you would be, maybe you had who was the most inspiring leader, national leader for you personally, and why?
So I'm not sure I was inspired by any leaders in this book. Okay. So, you know, if you take someone like Angela Merkel, when faced with the refugee crisis, she took a stance that to some degree was principled. It certainly was principled in a way that David Cameron's response to the refugee crisis, it was not. He talked about a swarm of migrants coming into the European Union, whereas Merkel had a pragmatic approach to try and work through this. But Merkel also stood by Orban as a member of the EPP. So, I tried to, I guess, deal with a set of politicians who are inherently flawed in this story. And my desire was not to tell a history of the EU that somehow put them on a pedestal. I was interested in kind of knocking them off that pedestal at times.
So let us talk about an enfant terrible of European integration or the EU, because you remind us about the political crisis that occurred when the Austrian Freedom Party and Jörg Haider used xenophobic rhetoric and spoke against the values of the EU. In the beginning of the 2000s, sorry. And the situation as you presented was handled by the national leaders who mobilized themselves to collectively bring action to Austria, even though you mentioned that it was not to a great success at the end. But nowadays, seemingly similar problem with member states not respecting EU values is rather handled by the European Commission and the EU leaders, and not by the national leaders who are reluctant to act. So why do you think this is the case? And what does such a shift reveal to you?
So it's a really interesting question. Did the EU handle the 1999 election in Austria, which saw Jörg Haider's Austria Freedom Party come to power? Well, I mean, initially, EU leaders took a pretty principled stance on this. And I argue in the book that this was due in no small measure to Antonio Guterres, who was a president in office of the EU at the time. And he was, I think, very informed by his own experience of right-wing authoritarianism in Portugal. And he reminded other EU leaders very quickly of their historic responsibilities. And their initial response was to essentially sideline Austria, to have an empty chair crisis of sort, and to really try to defend the EU's values. They then took a decision, and the decision was to ask the president of the European Court of Human Rights to head up a wise persons group that would travel to Austria and find out some facts on the ground and then report back to the European Union. And I think this was a really sliding doors moment for the European Union, because that group, as you pointed out, acknowledged that the Austrian Freedom Party had used, and I quote, xenophobic or even racist language, while proposing at the same time to call off the sanctions on Austria, which wasn't really the point of that high-level group. They were there to gather facts, but they made quite a normative recommendation. And EU leaders were very quick to climb down that ladder. So they took this principled stance and they quickly backed down. And this was, I think, a really important turning point and a problematic one for EU fundamental rights, because it showed the fear that EU leaders had of taking on leaders on a point of national sovereignty. Now, if we fast forward to the implications today, I think this helps to understand why those kind of norms that EU leaders found so objectionable in the 1990s have become mainstream today, and we haven't actually seen a very effective pushback against it. I'm talking here about, for example, Hungary and Portugal. We could talk about other states. Hungary and Poland, but I could talk about other states too. As for the Commission, I mean, what's interesting is the shift there, because Prodi, as Commission president in 1999, didn't want to confront a member state head on. And so the Commission was fairly quiet in this story. And of course, we have the opposite today, where the Commission has tried, at least to some extent, to hold member states to account, but with little effectiveness. And I think the answer there is due to member states. Member states are simply not willing to back the European Commission up on this. Article 7 is never going to get unanimity in the European Council. So what's the implication of this is that the EU has been fairly successful at codifying its values post-Maastricht, but much less successful at defending those.
Thank you for that. You mentioned also that you focus in your book on three types of actors, so leaders, national leaders, EU officials, and then right-wing populist politicians. So let's get into them. Because you claim that around the ratification of the Amsterdam Treaty, Euroscepticism was associated with preserving the member states' influence over European integration rather than embracing disintegration. But in the book appears this yet another term, exactly, right-wing populism, that assumes many forms. You applied it to the anti-EU sentiments in the UK Conservative Party during Major's term, to the anti-enlargement approaches in diverse member states before 2004, or to the disregard for EU values that is presented by Hungary and Poland. Then what would be the difference between legitimate criticism of the EU and right-wing populism? And how to deal with the fact that Euroscepticism, for example, is found on the left as well, as we know from as we know this was the case for the Labour Party of the 1970s, which was the opponent of the European integration because of the labour unions and globalization. This would be the question.
Okay, so I mean, I acknowledge in the book that Euroscepticism is as old as the European project itself. It's present in the 1950s and 1960s. But I argue that something changes around the time of Maastricht, that you get a new sort of right-wing populism that has the EU in its sights. And I focus a lot on the early part of the book on Sir James Goldsmith, this Anglo-French billionaire, who I argue was very influential in setting a new direction for this sort of Euroscepticism. So if we compare, for example, Margaret Thatcher's Bruges speech at the College of Europe in 1988 with Sir James Goldsmith, I think you start to see these differences, right? So what was Thatcher worried about? Thatcher was essentially worried about the rolling back of the state in the UK being replaced by a sort of European socialism led by Jacques Delors. So she was worried about state building at the EU level. So James Goldsmith, who had been a conservative a donor for many years at this point, and someone who had advised Thatcher, he had a very different sort of argument. His argument was that you had these faceless technocrats in Brussels who were building a borderless Europe, and this borderless Europe would leave the EU vulnerable to global competition, particularly from developing countries. So the story that emerges there is not about the building of a state, but it's about a borderless Europe, which is vulnerable to global competition. So Goldsmith, in a way, taps into these new debates on globalization in the 1990s and points towards a very different sort of Euroscepticism. So that's one difference. I think another difference is that this right-wing populism is, as Cas Mudde and others have argued, a thin-centered ideology, right? It's very different than the sort of Euroscepticism that is embedded in a wider political program on the right or on the left. And you again see this in Sir James Goldsmith, who sets up his own party to run for office in 1997 in the UK general election. And his promise is that he's going to do one thing as prime minister and then resign. And now what's the one thing? He's going to pass a bill that will allow a referendum on the UK's membership of the EU, and then he's going to resign after 100 days. So I think that really captures the idea of this thin-centered ideology, right? It doesn't really stand for much else on the right or on the left. It's very narrowly focused on this discontent with the European project. And I think that's what makes it populist in quite a pure sense.
What do you think is the reason behind this right-wing populism in the European Union? I mean, do you think that some of this criticism raised by right-wing populists is spurred by the actions of the European Union? Or do you think that some of the points raised by those right-wing populists are valid?
So as I argue in the book, I think it's heads of state or government with their very naive view of globalization that have created a space for right-wing populism to thrive. And right-wing populists have been very quick to pick up on the fact that this is a very uncaring, naive vision of globalization that doesn't take account of the fact that trade is better for businesses and consumers rather than workers. So in that respect, it's quite a shrewd politics. But it's also, as I mentioned earlier, this thin-centered ideology. So Goldsmith is not much interested in solutions. He's interested in critique. And so it's I think that defines his political project. The fact that it isn't embedded in this wider political program that offers a different way to think about globalization, it just sees this as a new cleavage in politics and it rapidly picks up on it. But that's largely what it stands for, I think.
And My question now would be more concrete. Like, what do you think about the transformation or the process of Meloni's government or Meloni's position within the European Union? Because she started as an outsider, so to say, but now she seems to be in the middle of the European politics. She is treated not as an outsider like Orban or Kaczynski or Morawiecki, but rather as one of the European leaders who are there to lead the European Union, not only the nation state.
Well, I think the key word in what you said is treated. It's not what she is, it's how she's treated. So I think one of the things I picked up on in writing the book was the sense in which political norms had shifted, right? And if we look at that pushback against Haider, it might not have been effective, but there was a sense in which this was a violation of political norms. The fact that we were told consistently that Meloni had changed, that she was a different sort of politician. We saw the same thing about Marine Le Pen in both French presidential elections. Tells us not about those politicians, but I think it tells us something about the political environment in which we now live. Those norms have shifted. And so I find it troubling that Meloni has been integrated, if you want, so easily into the European Council. And the fact that Ursula von der Leyen, again, a leader, I think, who has shown some real vision on some policy areas, particularly in the response to COVID-19, for example, is so quick to try and join forces with Meloni on something like migration in the controversial migration pact with Tunisia. Am I surprised by this? No, because I think in a way we see it also with Orban. If you look behind the headlines and if you look at behind what's said in general election campaigns, there is a day-to-day cooperation there with Orban. And there are challenger governments who are integrated surprisingly easily into the European Council. And that tells us a lot about the withering of certain EU norms over the last 30 years.
Let us now move to the critical part of our conversation, because one of the aspects that you approach critically in your book is the social aspect of the European Union and the outcomes of the third way politics. You mentioned, for example, the protesters who demanded more social Europe around the time of the ratification of the Nice Treaty, and these claims were not taken into account. So in your opinion, why a proper European social constitution has never been designed?
Well, if I try and think along the lines of the third way leaders, I think they inherited a Europe with very high unemployment. And they came to see labor regulation as an impediment to job creation, rightly or wrongly. And so they looked at this high unemployment. They experimented with active labor market policies in the Netherlands and Denmark and the UK. They watched what was happening in the US and they saw the apparent success of active labor market policies and the rolling back of tight employment regulation. And they, I think, came to believe that globalization was going to happen anyway. And if we could have growth, this would ultimately trickle down and benefit workers. But I think the limitations of this approach, and they were significant, became apparent in a number of ways. Certainly when the global financial crisis hit, we saw how vulnerable workers were to changes in the global economy. We also saw it in the referendum in France on the European Constitution, where this was a treaty that had little to say about social policy, and there was a huge backlash against it on the left in France. The reply was, well, they're talking about something that's not in the treaty. That's kind of the point, right? There was very little social Europe there. I also talk in the book about Jacques Delors' vision of social partnership. So, of course, Delors was a socialist who believed that the single market could be combined with social Europe, in which representatives of the trade unions and employers would sit down together and perhaps even draft legislation. And I talk about how that vision quickly withered in the post-Maastricht period, in which the single market very much dominated the social Europe project, and early attempts at cooperation between the social partners actually didn't achieve very much. So I think there was a sense on the left that we didn't need these social protections, that growth would be enough. But I think the global financial crisis and the backlash against the European Constitution showed how flawed that was. And if you go after the global financial crisis, you see the left in decline. There's simply not the political power base there to try and push through and revisit that idea of social Europe.
Now I started to think about yet another discourse that is now apparent in the European Union or around European Union in domestic states, in domestic contexts. So the problem of competence creep. I mean, how do you approach it? I mean, do you see it as a novel discourse that appeared only fairly recently, I don't know, maybe around the Lisbon Treaty? Or do you see that as a constant feature of European integration, this discourse on, you know, the European Union is doing too much and we have to protect ourselves from the European influence?
So, I mean, it's somehow inherent in the European Union that's built on these three very ambitious projects that are going quite close to core state powers and economic policy and foreign policy and justice and home affairs. So it's not surprising to me that that discourse takes hold. On the other hand, I think often that discourse looks in the wrong place for who's exercising power. So there's a tendency to look at technocrats as somehow the drivers of this a competence creep in this policymaking. So we see this in the euro crisis, for example, with a heavy emphasis on what officials of the European Commission were doing on negotiations with countries that required financial assistance, or Mario Draghi's intervention with bond purchases and unconventional monetary policies. So this, in a sense, those two discourses come together, where the EU is involved in these very sensitive areas of cooperation and technocrats are in the lead in exercising that power. I challenge that view in the book, where I think it's heads of state or government who are driving that cooperation forward. And if you look at the euro crisis, it was the heads of state or government that decided to save the euro long before Mario Draghi gave his speech. And I think it's the heads of state or government who should be held to account for the choices they made in that period. So the delay in providing financial assistance to Greece, the harsh conditions attached to that financial assistance, the failure really to understand the basics of debt sustainability dynamics, giving more and more money to a country that simply had not got a sustainable debt. So the EU is involved in very, very sensitive areas of cooperation. But I find that discourse that it's faceless technocrats that are driving it forward is problematic, and it doesn't really understand who genuinely governs the contemporary EU.
So this is maybe the point, the very good point to ask the question about democratic deficit. Because in the forum with Moravčík's contribution to which you refer, the forum that you quote towards the end of your book, one of the authors, Christopher Lord, argues that in order to refute a claim of democratic deficit, one has to be able to show that national publics and parliaments can control those who exercise power in the EU, and it is not enough to demonstrate that member state governments can control EU institutions. So how do you approach the problem of democratic deficit?
So I mean, as an intergovernmentalist, I'm quite influenced by Andrew Moravčík's work. And so he's written this, I think, really, really interesting take on the democratic deficit, which argues, well, there isn't really a democratic deficit because governments drive integration forward, and those governments are in turn accountable to their own national parliaments and electorate. I think that argument is elegant, but it doesn't really work in practice, because actually it's governments who have huge problems of legitimacy in the post-Maastricht period, and they kind of imprint those problems of legitimacy onto the European Union. So take something like Brexit. The UK is a parliamentary democracy with a tradition of royal prerogative. So it usually ratifies treaties by putting them before the House of Commons, allowing for debate, and then approving those treaties. This is what the UK did with treaty after treaty, but it fails to bring that legitimacy, that traditional mechanism of accountability, which I think should have worked in the Moravčík account, didn't work in practice. So what do you see at this point? You see these traditional levers of legitimation breaking down, and there's a scramble to find new ways to achieve legitimacy. And this is where the referendum idea comes from. There is no great tradition of referendum in the UK. It's a parliamentary democracy. And yet we see this referendum in 2016. Cameron thinks it's going to win legitimacy. And of course, like so many other votes in the post-Maastricht period, it exposes big problems. So the idea that the EU has a democratic deficit should be taken seriously, but it should be embedded in a much more nuanced discussion of why politics has a democratic deficit and why there's a wider problem of legitimacy facing the European Union. But I'm also a little bit torn in the book, right? Because you have the last 30 years is a period in which the European Parliament thrived, right? The European Parliament, the world's only directly elected transnational parliament wins more and more power, it becomes more prominent. And I think there's often a failure to acknowledge just how unique that is in the European case. And also these governments are in charge. The forum that you referred to, I guess, is the Conference on the Future of Europe, which is the subject of the last section of the book. And for me, this was a hugely interesting and entertaining experience for the European Union. This idea of getting citizens around the table, listening to them, but not really knowing what to do, what they were told. And so the citizens invest a lot of time in trying to work through proposals on the future of the EU. The European Parliament had really hoped they'd talk about treaty reform. Instead, they talked about something entirely different. So their proposals included things like cycling lanes. The EU needs to get involved in euthanasia. I mean, it terrified EU policymakers to hear what citizens had to say. And there was a very quick attempt, I think, to sideline their more radical ideas. And so I end the book on purpose by trying to draw these citizens into what turned into quite an interesting kind of explosive moment for the European Union, in which it got very close to citizens and didn't really know what to do with what it was hearing. And the citizens at the very end of that Conference on the Future of Europe say, well, we've worked through our differences. We've come up with a set of ideas. It's over to you to see what you can do with this. At which point there's a lot of awkward silence from the EU leaders in the room.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think that the European Parliament triggered the process of the treaty change because they wanted to somehow implement the solutions or the ideas that citizens produced during the Conference on the Future of Europe. So do you think that the EU institutions might pursue pressure on the national leaders to rethink the EU architecture in the current circumstances of the war, of the migration crisis, which is getting bigger and bigger, the climate crisis, you know? What would be your take on that?
Well, I think the European Parliament would have come up with a plan for treaty change, whatever the citizens had said in the Conference on Future of Europe. That was kind of the point. And so I think there's an instrumental character to saying, okay, we've heard you. What you need is treaty reform. I would really question that. But I also think this is an interesting moment for the EU, where the European Parliament is claiming a kind of constitutional role by saying, you know, we are the actor who can instigate treaty change. There's a long tradition of this going all the way back to Spinelli in the early 1980s when he prepared a draft treaty on the European Union. But I think what you've seen consistently happen is that heads of state or government decide, for better or worse, where the treaties go ahead. And I think two things could happen at this point. One is that heads of state or government could follow the pattern of the last few years, which is to avoid treaty changes at all costs for fear of this backlash. There's a kind of short-termism about that. Rather than kind of addressing people's discontent, they say, well, let's not get too close to the people in case we have the kind of backlash that we saw against Lisbon and other treaties. But I think there's another scenario that's possible, is that the heads of state or government, while they make up their mind about whether Ukraine should be a member and whether other countries should come in, that they throw out treaty reform as a kind of stalling tactic. And I think there's a real possibility of this. You know, if you go back to debates over the Nice Treaty and the European Constitution, the argument was made that the EU would come to a halt when we had 10 countries join. I mean, I think that was probably exaggerated, but what we saw was a decade or more taken up with treaty reforms that didn't necessarily help the EU to cope with enlargement, but led to this long drawn out constitutional crisis for the EU. So it's not impossible to imagine that something similar happens in Ukraine. So rather than addressing head on the question of whether Ukraine should become a member, we're told that the EU should change and the EU then disappears into another problematic period of introspection.
Great. Thank you for that. I mean, here we will stop. So thank you very much for your time and insights.
Thank you very much for your time too.
And up until the next time.